Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Cellular Medicine Podcast. I am here again. We took a little break and we're finally back. I want to say I have to specify where we're back. We're back in America. It's been a little crazy. The past 12 months have been a little chaotic, Doc, but this past month in particular has been a little nuts. We just got back from the Cellular Medicine World Congress out there in London. It was our first event outside of the United States. Such a great event. And then things changed, right, Doc? And before I dive into this, we want to welcome you not only to this episode, but the purpose of this episode is really influenced by some recent events that have happened, not just in my life, but my family's life. And we are very closely tied to, of course, the care of Dr. Seeds. So he has been an integral part of everything happening. And I have permission from my family to be able to speak on this today. So it's been a little crazy. I haven't experienced something quite like this before. And it became evident that if someone like me who works so closely with Dr. Seeds felt very much blindsided by what happened, how much the rest of the world must feel when something like this is unfortunately more common than it isn't. So this episode is dedicated to that, to preventative healthcare, preventative medicine, all these things. And I have to rewind back, Doc, to one of my first videos that I saw of you, even before I ever knew you, was you were giving a video interview to another organization. And you're talking about, this is probably like 7 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, maybe even longer. But you said something that totally stood out, and it is prevention is the future of medicine. And it's preventing all of these things from happening. That's the future of medicine. So that is the theme for today's episode. It's the prevention episode. And it's oftentimes, I want to say, given a bad rap because it's a little boring, right? It takes the most hard work, I think. And that's why it's a little bit of a snooze fest, but this is ever the more important why it's so important to talk about it and to make some real look at your prevention strategies for health and take a quick look at it. Before we begin, though, everything that we talk about today is for educational purposes only. If you have any sort of concerns of your own, please make sure that you speak with your own healthcare provider about it. Doc, should we just get right back into it?
I think people are interested in where you're going with this. You're holding everybody hostage.
Yes.
Let's get to it.
So we finished Cellular Medicine World Congress. Doc was staying an extra couple of days in London. We decided we wanted to make the most out of flying all the way over to Europe. And my family and close friends helps us out with the events. You know, they help us with the camera work and all that. They were with me. I had a nice group. We had a group of seven people, including myself, that the very next day we were heading off to Paris. We're going to do Paris, we're going to do Barcelona, and then we're going to end the trip in Ibiza and then come back and start work again. It was going to be a little week-long, little siesta vacation. Unfortunately, one of our travel, my very close, basically my sister, I've known her basically my whole life. She came down with the flu or something even before she came to London. They had started off in Italy and they were in Italy. She caught something and she came to London with what we thought was a minor cold. And as we were progressing through London and the Cellular Medicine Summit ended, it got worse and worse, but still nothing alarming. We thought nothing out of the ordinary. She just has a cold. That day we flew to Paris and she was the worst condition I've ever seen her in Paris. Very, very little energy. And we still just thought, okay, she's just fragile and she has a cold. I've been communicating this with Doc, and Doc's been helping us out with some supplements and things of that nature. We got on the flight. They almost didn't let us go on the flight, by the way. They almost didn't let us take off from Paris because she was in a wheelchair because she couldn't walk. And still, I'm looking back going, oh my God, you're such an idiot, Karen. But we just thought, hey, she has a cold. Like, it doesn't even dawn on us that something more serious might be happening. So talking through all the stewardesses, we were assuring them that she doesn't have COVID, blah, 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 blah. They decided, okay, they're going to let her fly. They even at one point took her passport away and then they gave it back to us. So we got on the plane. We're taking off. Awesome. Things are fine. We land in Paris. Okay. She's still in that state. We get to our Airbnb and she's still very, very weak. So she decides to take a nap. We go out for lunch and we come back, and it was me and my husband. We come back first and she's got like a paper bag and she's breathing out of it by the time I got to her after lunch. And at that point it was very serious. You're not using a paper bag if you have a flu. So we tried to convince her to go to a clinic, an urgent care clinic that we found. Long story short, we had to carry her to the clinic, who then called the hospital, and she got to the hospital and it turns out she is 43 years old, acute heart failure. Heart's working at 15 to 20%. Ejection fraction is what I've learned it was called. I think that means, Doc, her heart was working at 15 to 20%. Is that correct?
Pretty much.
So we were kind of down to the wire at that point. Because she's seemingly very healthy. You know, she works with Dr. C's, right? We exercise together here and there, right? And we do everything we can to stay really healthy. No history of heart failure or heart issues in the past. And all of a sudden, heart failure. So had to deal with all of that. It got worse and worse and worse. She went through. We were thankfully at a hotel where our hospital that specializes in cardiovascular diseases. And she was put on ECMO, which I don't know what it stands for, but it basically is a machine outside of your body that acts like a heart and pumps oxygen throughout your body. And yeah, a very few hospitals can do this. And we happen to be at the one of two hospitals in all of France who can do this. So things got worse from there, right? Her kidney started failing. She was at risk for a lot worse. So we got through it.
Tough, isn't it?
It really makes you wonder, though, how prepared are you, right? How prepared are you? How prepared are your loved ones? And is this something that you should change in your life? So I get emotional still thinking about it. Because you're still in Paris, getting better, but still in Paris. And a lot of things have happened since then. She's still not in the clear, but her heart's fully recovered and her kidneys are now fully recovered. She might lose a couple of limbs, maybe some toes. But hey, at this point, we'll take it because we thought she was going to die. So that is, that's what happened to us. And I think when something like that happens, you not only want to share it, but you want to prevent it from happening to anybody else. So here we go. Doc, this is a prevention episode. The Dr. C's, the cellular medicine way, not really the intervention episode, but maybe we'll talk about that another day. But do you agree with what we said 10 years ago? And I think I know the answer to this, but it's worth repeating. It's the future of healthcare. It has to be prevention, right, Doc? And why? Why did you say that so long ago?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so heartwarming that you can share this and share your emotions and people can see these are real things that, you know, that again, you know, I'll keep telling you, and everybody gets caught like this, that these are not things you guys did everything right. You can't go back and look at the situation and say, what could I have done better? It's you got caught with things that you don't realize can happen. I mean, it happens to everybody. You get people who are healthy to a certain degree where, you know, as we're all aging, as we all get into environments and things change and you have an infection or a viral infection or whatever, things can change fast. And unfortunately, you were caught in that whirlwind and you experienced it firsthand. And it's a traumatic experience for all of you. And you did a wonderful job and you continue to do a wonderful job. And I think it's really wonderful that you can look back and and look at the process and say, gosh, what can I do to help other people so maybe they don't have to go through some of the things I did? Or what can we do to move forward to get this message out that preventative care, or what I like to call cytoprotection, or protect the cell, give it its best chance at any onslaught of problems. Where are we with that? Where, you know, no matter what stage you are in life, are there things that we can do? And the answer is, it has many answers, actually. And the answer is yes. But even it's the degree of onslaught. It's the degree of what strikes you with, you know, how can the body adapt to what's happening and changing? How can we fight? And you want to just give the body, the cells, the best playing field they can to fight the fight. And that is where I think this is so important for people to understand. There are, you know, we talk about a lot of detailed aspects of cell function and all these interesting things we can do at a high level to help people. You know, we can get into all the details of being on certain molecules and peptides that can absolutely change the playing field and protect people, and protect them significantly, as we saw through COVID, a perfect example of helping people be more prepared. But I think this just kind of lends itself to all the things we talk about, a good diet, we talk about exercise. Those things can be crucial in helping people prepare for events like this. And we can never forget that. We can never forget that diet and exercise are always at the forefront. But I think this gives us a great opportunity to talk about something so simple. And I'm going to just jump into this, if you're okay with this, is just talk about something so simple as hydration and how actually we've spent a lot of time on this in higher sessions with physicians, in explaining the world is basically underhydrated. Hydration has everything to do with, I believe, where we're seeing a divergence in healthcare and problems with immune disease and metabolic diseases. And we can trace this all back to hydration. And that message never was delivered more clearly than this year, when, especially with the feedback we got from our physicians about, oh my gosh, where has this been? Where has this information been? Well, it's been around for 20 years. It's just been building slowly, and no one has realized the significance of keeping a cell at its optimal size, meaning keeping the cell so the cell membrane is in a hyperpolarized state to take advantage of all the receptors and influences that it is supposed to undergo 24/7. And meaning, if you imagine a balloon that you're blowing up and you keep it at its optimal size, that's what I'm talking about as a cell, because a cell then has so many adaptive functions that work better. And we can validate that. We have real data to validate this. And it even goes into issues of things that we figured out a long time ago with liver issues and liver disease, and how important hydration is from that standpoint. But starting off in that cellular world at looking at liver disease. But my emphasis here, and then I'll let you ask any questions you wish to, is so simple. It's so simple that we've missed the boat. And hydration is the key. And I'll use one example just to start the conversation. If a cell is ultimately hydrated at the appropriate size, then the cell itself is set in a position where most people don't realize that viral penetration and viral replication in a cell like that becomes very difficult. Very difficult. And it's been proven that viral replication is inhibited or seriously downregulated in an optimal cell size. And that's just the introduction to, that should set off you know, the fireworks in the brain of, are you kidding me?
That's insane.
You're talking about just cell hydration can make a difference. And
wow. And
the answer is absolutely it can. And what I'd like to just kind of just lay the framework for here is we can absolutely relate diabetes, metabolic disease, immune disease, liver disease, kidney disease. We can relate all of these things back to hydration of the cell, and the data is significant. In fact, as you know, that's one of the many books I'm finishing right now is just a simple book on hydration. And we spent a whole mastermind at a high level talking about it. And now we're introducing it to the public, where the public needs to know that simple things like this can make a big difference. And there's simple things you can do to ensure that hydration. And I think that's maybe where we'll go with this. But I can't emphasize it enough. It's been a way I've been living for a long 20 years plus on understanding how important hydration is in my world and what it's done for me. And I think one of the best examples that I'll bring back time and time again is our first mastermind that we had a couple years ago, 2-3 years ago, right, in Denver, where we had our first group. What was it? 3 years ago that we had. And we brought our first group in to start the messaging on redox and all of these things that are so important in cell function. And I introduced this hydration drink, and it was so amazing to be able to share that and share the relevance and share the issues that, of why it's so important and how it affects cell redox and so forth. And then to take that forward into the docs and the fellows who lived that way, you know, who chose that path of taking some easy choices just by, hey, let's start with this hydration. Let's see how it really, you know, will be the example for our patients. Incredible to see that. Incredible to see the continuation of that. And then to be able to go forward back in Vail at our IV course and to bring that to fruition 3 years later and have the docs there that, you know, we're always showing up with their jugs and their water and what a difference it's made in their journey to get to where they're at a health level that is, I think, unparalleled, but real examples of what you could use to show these journeys of the people who are trying to change lives in their own areas for, you know, simple things for people to do and information that means so much. And it was just the perfect time to bring all of that together. And I don't think the message could have been any clearer. The timing, again, was just, it was amazing. But it gave you the feedback, the legitimate feedback that the rest of the people online, all the people there were seeing, like, oh my gosh, this is something that's been talked about continually. And look at these changes. Look at this data they're presenting. And oh my gosh, how is this possible that this is not something we're spending more time on for everybody in the world to understand? And that's where the significance, I think, is the first step that anybody can take, right? A perfect example is the long COVID aspects of people that, you know, with POTS syndromes and all of these problems that have been looked at with multiple modalities of treatment and so forth. And we just get the ability to, you know, we always see them at the tail end, but we get the ability to use things like a simple hydration technique that changes just this aspect of a serious problem post-COVID for people. You know, that's an example of many places this fits in hydration and not just sports, and how sports has it wrong, how they have it wrong with these Gatorades and these things that potentially can make hydration even worse and the process of that worse. And so that's where I'll leave it. It was long-winded, but I mean, oh my gosh, this hydration thing is so real, and it hits a nerve knowing that just simple little steps to recreate something that can keep a cell at its optimal size is a tremendous statement to be able to make.
I mean, you said just incredible things there. I had no idea that if a cell is better, is well hydrated, that it actually stops viral replication. That's huge. No, I don't know that I was paying attention when you even said that at IV, but this is the thing. It's like you don't pick up on all of the pearls that you're giving away, Doc, sometimes. And that one is the one that made me go, whoa. Something as simple as, but is it as simple as drinking more water, Doc? Because then you mentioned the amino acid drink, which I know very well about, but it's almost like you're not saying, oh, it's not just water, and it's certainly not Gatorade, as you were just alluding to just now. Is it also, like, I also heard from another doctor who was talking about this, like, just drinking water isn't going to keep you hydrated. It's like the minerals in the water. I don't know if that's true or false, but I would love to get your specifics on that, like how to better hydrate.
Yeah, it isn't, unfortunately. I wish it was that simple. I mean, early on in life, yes, it can be incredible. But as we're aging, as time changes, we have to do more to work on some things that have been working against us. And we've all put ourselves in this position by not hydrating early enough in life. I mean, it's a very slow, it's why the data's been around and why it keeps growing after 20, 30 years. And where we have these big populations that we can look at to correlate this information and make some pretty significant statements that basically what happens is I'm not saying dehydrated, I'm just saying the word underhydration, where the cell just isn't optimal. But our cells demand to be optimal, right? It's just like putting good gas in a car or taking care of the engine. Your engine is only as good as what you put into it. And knowing that if we just knew some simple things about hydration and that over time, it takes a toll on the body. And by what I mean is the body's job is to adapt. The body's job is to fix problems. And the body has a way of, if we're not hydrating, it'll activate some hormones in the brain. It'll activate some ways to bring more volume into the body that it may be losing. Well, when it does that, there are sacrifices. And we've never been able to really put it together, I think, until as of late, of understanding that these sacrifices are significant sacrifices over time. And it's always this stuff over time that affects us slowly that we don't pick up, we don't see. But it only makes sense, right? It is disease, injury, all of these things as we get older seem to be accumulating. And you can correlate all this to the hydration of the cell. And I'm making some big statements here that people are going to question and they're going to, but we can absolutely provide the information and back this up, which we're going to be talking more about in the World Congress, that I think people will be impressed and amazed at where this is going. And the fact that we can correlate and prove that the body actually has these mechanisms, which makes sense, right? It's all, the body is just brilliant. The cells are, the body's trying to compensate and adapt to the environmental change. And that means just over time, slowly not getting what it needs to. So it's going to work on ways of bringing fluid back into the body, right? To keep what we call total body water at its optimal. Okay. That's its goal. Well, by doing so, what nobody's been aware of or hasn't really correlated or found or looked at is there's sacrifices with that, because we used to think that some of these things the brain releases only affects one thing. But actually, when that happens, it affects other organs. It affects the adrenals. It affects the liver. It affects the kidney. And over time, those processes, because the receptors that are activated, even though the body's compensated and we could, it all might look good in the lab, you know, that, oh, blood looks good, my fluid volume's good, it actually doesn't work out that way. It starts this slow cascade of problems that occur by losing the cell volume and cells working inefficiently and leading to issues with increasing like glucagon production by the liver or glucose production in the liver, gluconeogenesis that just gets activated, more cortisol release by the adrenals. These are real things. These are really happening over time in a very slow attrition. And as these things build up, they start leading to these processes that we see, that being, you know, the beginning of metabolic problems and inefficiencies of the cell to use glucose and fatty acids and proteins when it's supposed to, and leading into early stage pre-diabetes, diabetes, and so on. So you can imagine if a cell is not able to function at its optimal, well, that means every cell. We're talking about neurons. We're talking about microglial cells that are immune cells in the brain. We're talking about muscle cells. We're talking about every cell. We're talking about liver cells that are important in excreting toxins. Big statement there, excreting toxins through bile. Bile is the biggest factor the liver has besides the systems of detoxification, two stages to detoxify the body. Bile is the biggest player there. Okay. Well, that is affected by hydration of the cell, and that is proven data. So imagine all these things that are happening and slowly happening over time. You can start to see this picture of, oh my gosh, if now we start looking for these parameters, it really makes sense what's happening. And it's just phenomenal when you know, we're cellular medicine physicians, we're focused on every aspect of the cell. Well, we can do all these things in helping to change cell function with signaling and, like I said, exercise, diet. And so, well, you have to also focus on hydration to make all of these receptors and everything work well. And it's an overwhelming amount of information to support this assumption that is now validated that we are all living in a world of underhydration. And I think it's more than validated, and it will now maybe, by getting this message out and putting this all together, and hopefully as this book explodes, we'll get more people interested in this aspect of, you know, I don't want to make a statement that sounds overzealous, but when you go to an IV clinic and you get your IV and they're going to, you get all your vitamins, you get all these things that people are saying, hey, this is going to make you better. What's making you better? What's making you feel the difference right away? It's hydration. It's the cell having the ability to change to some degree. But what we're talking about in, I think where we're going is, you know, we've looked at some ways over time to actually formulate and put together a way to influence fluid back into the cell. And at the same time, have other benefits that will correlate with using certain peptides and things to add to structure and to add to signaling and to make a difference. So it really comes down to understanding that there is this aspect of disease that can absolutely be correlated back to this hydration, which is, I think, just incredible and fascinating. But if you have that information, and then we're able to act on it, and then we can show these changes. We showed it in the athletic world first, and then we introduced it into disease states, autoimmune, metabolic states, and we started changing those people. And that's where I think the proof is in the pudding when, you know, then we brought this to the physicians over 3 years ago to start implementing. And that's where, you know, when your docs are all doing it, you got to take notice, and you got to say, if my doc's doing that and they're pretty representative of good health, they walk the talk, maybe it's something I should take a look at. And it's just such a simple thing to do. It's inexpensive to do. But it should be a daily part of the routine. And it means more as we age, actually. It becomes more of a significant fact because of how this is built up over time. And there's no deniability in it. And then there's this other aspect of this world where, you know, we've been caught up in all these sports drinks that potentially make that issue even worse, of where this hormone, because of certain aspects of how these drinks work. And I don't know how, I don't want to get into this, or I can if you want me to. There are aspects of why these things actually can potentially make things worse over time. And how we've been pulled into this world of thinking that we're taking these drinks that are supposed to be hydrating drinks that are actually not doing that job. And that's a big statement to make. That's a huge statement to make. And again, it just depends on the state of everyone as they're progressing through this issue with underhydration. And again, I say underhydration. It's huge. It's a huge topic. My goal is to make it a bigger topic and to just inform people with information, and then we can have better discussions. But I think we've got, you know, the place we've been is we've already been there, and we're doing things to make changes for people that are just significant, and you can't deny it. So how is that? How am I doing without going too crazy? As I've been said, Dr. Seeds, don't talk too cellular or you're going to lose everybody. You got to, let's make it understandable. Let's make it so people ask the right questions.
We will certainly continue to give up. $0.02, but Doc, you pulled so many, there's so many takeaways in what you just said, but I feel like some really important takeaways need to be repeated. And it is that you need to start this very early, almost like it instate this kind of habit, these good habits with kids and teens, and have them hydrate always so that the cell isn't having to adapt under those conditions. That's what I was hearing. And that Gatorade is no good. What do you drink?
Well, it has a purpose, but yeah. It's not, it has to do with some mechanisms of like things that we think may not have fructose, but when they're broken down into their basic components, there is some fructose in that. And it's how these actually interact with the liver and what the body does to compensate for that. And the fact that they actually are working against hydration, when you would think as osmotics, as we're sold that they are what they are, when they're really not intracellular osmotics, they actually work against us, especially as we're aging and we're dealing with all of these issues of how the body utilizes certain resources, you know, like glucose and amino acids and fatty acids, you know, proteins, amino acids and fatty acids. It really comes down to what the body sees, and things like this that are potentially in these drinks, or, you know, drinking fruit juices and so forth, can actually work against us in that capacity. It's a real important take-home message here to understand that. And we go into that in great detail and why those mechanisms are there, and just for people to understand. And maybe we break this out into a couple episodes, you know, to really get down to those issues. But it's something that we have to be, because the cell, just imagine if the cell loses its ability to keep at its optimal size, we know that any shrinkage of the cell, even small percentages, what does it do? It increases oxidative stress in the cell. And that's been proven time and time again in the liver. And it's what happens with, as liver disease progresses, and we've proven it. And that oxidative stress is, again, all comes back to redox and everything we profess about redox. So it's all about, you know, trying to educate the public and understanding that there are things that, guess what? Some big changes you can make now, especially in your children and moving forward, that can make, I think, significant changes in everybody's lives in understanding a simple concept. And it's all about setting up your biochemical pathways or reactions that are so dependent on structure, water content, pH, ionic strength, temperature, pressure. All these things have to do with hydration. And I think this is a huge concept that we're going to bring to a new understanding and a new meaning.
I like that. I like it a lot, Doc. And you were not the most popular in the room, man in the room, by the way, when you said with the IV room, when you said, hey, the number one reason people feel good is because of the saline.
But it's good. It's a good thing. I mean, it's not, there are other things that follow with the saline, absolutely, with the fluid.
Absolutely.
I'm just giving you the real facts of, yeah, hydration is the initial why people feel better when they have an IV, because
absolutely
they're underhydrated. And
hydrated.
You know, I wouldn't be doing the due diligence of telling people the facts if it wasn't that it's a simple concept. It makes sense to everyone. I mean, no, you can't refute that.
Absolutely. Well, we can't have a prevention episode and not talk about the number one killer in the US is still cardiovascular disease. So just shifting gears a little bit, and talking about healthy heart, right? What can we do to keep it healthy? What can we do to prevent it? I've learned so far, hydrate, do saline IVs. But what else, Doc? Lifestyle, peptides, other supplements, anything that our listeners can start doing?
Yeah. I think, again, to keep that simple is all the things we've been talking about, even atherosclerosis, even cardiac disease, can go right back to this hydration issue. We presented the data. It's all there. Cardiovascular disease is absolutely related to this topic. Again, it's the mechanisms it puts into play of how things can start to change when a cell loses its size and what happens to the lipid structure around the cell and the changes in the lipid structure. But that being said, let's just go to some simple points, some very simple things about, I think, things that get confused, but we really need to understand, and I can make this very simple. The lipid profiles are everything to everyone, right? The lipid metabolism, meaning your cholesterol that you hear over and over and over again, your HDLs, your LDLs, all these things play a significant role in how you're evaluated, how you're followed, and it's what everybody's trying to treat and manage and modulate to keep the heart healthy, basically. Well, let's just imagine, let me just give you a simple concept of fat and cholesterol. And this concept, I think, could resonate to everyone and give them hopefully a new understanding of why they do certain things. So we hear so much about diet, and we hear so much about, oh my gosh, you're eating too many saturated fats, too many trans fats, too many of these fats are destroying your body and leading to heart disease. And that's where everything had started, and that's where a lot of literature has been reinforcing, but at the same point is now in a paradigm shift, meaning that we are actually at a point now where we've truly can understand some mechanisms of why we get into trouble. And it always comes back to balance. So let's just talk about fats in a diet. You've got saturated fats. You've got unsaturated fats, like polyunsaturated fats and monounsaturated fats. And so let's just look at it like that. And the saturated fats are the ones that have the bad rap, but are absolutely necessary for function, absolutely necessary for the brain, absolutely necessary for cell membrane, but are given a bad rap as far as they're the reason that people get into these issues with cholesterol and bad and plaque and all these things that go wrong in the heart. And to some degree, that's true. But the emphasis really lies in, is that saturated fat balanced with another type of fat? And we've got an incredible amount of data that shows us that if you have polyunsaturated fats that are balanced with saturated fats, you don't see those issues with these cholesterol issues or these lipid problems that become atherogenic and heart disease becoming significant. It actually comes down to the liver is basically your, just look at it as your liver. And what I'm trying to say is it's not all about the diet if you eat correctly. So what I'm trying to say is saturated fats, if you eat your steaks and your, you know, your foods that have higher saturated fats, you've got to make sure you balance it with a polyunsaturated fat like an omega-3. That's where these fish oils come into play. Why fish oils become such a big player in heart health? Because basically those fish oils, those omega-3s, what they do is they help in improving lipid profiles. Well, their real action, polyunsaturated fats like that, their action, there's other ones that we can mention, but specifically people are familiar with fish oils like the DHA, EPA stuff, DHA. What they do is they inhibit, they have a ability to decrease the amount of cholesterol, in particular bad cholesterol that the liver makes. And it's that simple. They turn off a mechanism that otherwise could be affected by an increase in saturated fat like palmitic acid or other types of arachidonic acid, things that could be problems if you didn't have this fish oil. So meaning a balance of a saturated fat and a polyunsaturated fat can change the whole makeup of metabolism. And let's say you think you're eating healthy and you're not getting enough polyunsaturated fats like omegas in your diet, and you're also eating more carbohydrates than you should. Well, those carbohydrates actually end up converting into fats. Okay, it's just a mechanism of how it turns the liver into a maker of fat and cholesterol, bad fats. But polyunsaturated fats like omegas can actually help balance that process. And again, you have to be control your carb intake. It can make a huge difference, in a huge difference. And so the reason I bring this up is because this has a significant role if people understood that balance. And that's why you take these fish oils. Now, the problem with fish oils are there are some issues people have with taking them, with gastrointestinal issues, things like that, and don't do well with them. The other thing is that they're very fragile, whether people know it or not. And there's issues with these fish oils that can be, even though everybody's trying to do their best job, they can oxidize and not be that valuable player that you want them to be in this whole world of supplementation, of where you're trying to even out that field and understanding what I just said. And that's why I think we've spent the time to introduce newer fatty acids into this world that have made their mark and are rising to the occasion of showing data, showing information that may make us think twice now about what are considered essential fatty acids. So omega-3s are considered an essential a fatty acid because it's necessary to help control this whole mechanism I've talked about. Well, newer things that are being available in supplementation that actually were around a long time ago when people had real dairy, had real fats that were balanced, okay? In real dairy, you get balance, you get saturated fats, and you get fats that, in particular, something that we brought to light with this research that we've talked about for a long time. And finally, a company came out that produced a supplement that represents this data. It's been around again for a long time, and it's a 15 odd chain saturated fatty acid that actually has the properties and acts like an omega-3 fatty acid and can improve oxidative stress and all these things in a cell that we've spent a lot of time talking about. and is on that track of showing the potential of how it can act like this omega-3 in the liver to do these things, but also be a source of energy for the cell. I mean, there's so many things to this fatty acid that we brought to light, and that is now becoming, they're doing an excellent job with the continued research and data that's coming out to emphasize the importance of, hey, we've got some choices now. And our job is to kind of let everybody be out there and present their information and present their data on why these things are important. So this brings to light even more importance that all saturated fatty acids aren't bad. There are actually some that are really good, and some that even improve, and some that have the potential to be better than omega-3 fatty acids. So it's an amazing world now where we've got so much information that needs to be shared that people need to know about. And just those simple rules of talking about fats, carbohydrates, and understanding the difference in these fats, I think can be a huge beginning for people to start looking into information a little bit more about, oh my gosh, are you saying that if I understand my diet correctly, that there's a balance of things that can make a huge difference in these players of why the liver can be your enemy if you're not balancing your fats in the right direction, even though you think you're doing things correctly, you know. So I hope that wasn't too complicated, but it's a prelude into some of the people we're going to be bringing on to discuss their fatty acids like this, what we're going to have presented at PwC, which I think is just incredible research, you know.
I still remember it, Doc. I still remember when you found their product, the pentadecanoic acid. I had to practice on how to say that correctly, by the way. You're so excited. You're so excited. And
it was about time. I've been waiting for it to come. And then it shows up and I'm like, are you kidding me?
Are you kidding me?
And then
real quick.
But then I just think they've done a tremendous job in messaging. And that's where, again,
yes,
the clinical data is coming even more and more so behind this. You know, omega-3s just have incredible clinical data, and it's great, and it'll never go away. It's a great option. It's there. It's the utilization of these omegas. Are you getting a good product, as opposed to, are there simpler ways? Are there ways where you can have a fatty acid that has even more uses? And that's how I look at it. I look at the multiple pathways all of these work, and what is my benefit? And is there benefit in using both? Right. So, you know, that's a discussion to continue. And all I want to do is try to make it that simple.
Yeah.
That it is all about balancing these fats.
Cool.
It makes such a difference in, because if you don't balance them, you're in trouble. You're going to be in trouble because there are mechanisms that are working against you that you're just not aware of. One being hydration. You know, under hydration turns on liver gluconeogenesis. That's the beginning of increased triglycerides, increased fatty acids, de novo lipogenesis, and progressing into increased LDL production and all these things you don't want to happen. Well, simple things like correcting and working on hydration and working on just understanding this balance of how do you just turn off the bad type of, how do you decrease, not turn off, but how do you manage that liver messaging to not be focused on that increase in cholesterol synthesis and significant lipid production? So I try to make that simple. Again, it's a very complicated subject, but it isn't if we do a good job in presenting the information to make it simple to understand. And I hope I was able to do that to some degree.
Oh, absolutely. And what you're describing, this, hey, it's about that balance. That's in theme with everything that you've been saying about the cell. It's this balance. And especially in the redox episode prior to this one, that was the major theme, was that balance between the oxidation and the reduction. I remember that one. But Doc, what you're describing to me is like the ultimate biohack. And I know that you don't love it when I describe you or I describe myself as biohack, but that to me is like what a biohacker needs to be looking at. It's not like, how am I going to fool the body? How am I going to fool the self? No, it's how am I going to balance the cells? And that needs to be the goal of the biohacker. And what you're describing now, when you're eating a steak and the omega acids help to balance out those saturated fats with the polyunsaturated, that to me is a true biohack, because it's actually doing something good for your cells rather than trying to fool it, which you can't do because it'll adapt. So I wonder, is there a time limit? Like when you eat a steak, should you just take a fatty 15 pentadecanoic acid, or is it like taking one throughout the day is enough to balance that out if you are having a steak?
Well, nobody has the direct answer to that. Mm-hmm. If they tell you they do, run away.
Okay.
But we can make assumptions and say, yeah, possibly, but it's very individual. I mean, I would look at it more under a 24-hour curve, as opposed to maybe trying to really get defined in each time we eat, though we should be. I mean, yes, you should try to balance every meal. I mean, it's probably makes more sense. And yes, but can we do things, you know, it's very hard sometimes to do all those things in an ideal world to do it in that fashion. But if we can try to do it under the circadian clock, remember, that we talk about so much, and believe it or not, that has a place here. If we try to just do some things to set us up to win, where we have, you know, some polyunsaturated fats or this pentadienoic acid on board that you took in the morning, and then you've got the potential of buffering some of the things you do throughout the day, it's actually very possible to do that. But should you balance it with every meal? That would be amazing. I mean, sure.
This is why you do surf and turf all the time, Doc.
Yeah, hello. But it's hard to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to make those demands on people. It's better to just get them going in the right direction and just understanding that you've got these choices to make things a little bit better for yourself and understand why you're doing it. I don't think people have really understood why they're taking an omega-3 other than it's an omega-3 and it's good for you. It has a real purpose. It's decreasing certain gene transcriptions. Specifically, it's affecting two areas of lipid production and cholesterol production. And we can get as specific to the specific genes. We have the data to show it, how it depresses the genes that activate these things, like the sterol response, elemental binding protein, and then the carbohydrate elemental binding protein, two of these things that are influencing lipogenesis and cholesterol synthesis, respectively. So it's a carbohydrate regulatory elemental binding protein, and then the sterol response elemental binding protein, and then it's like 1C, and they're just all these things that are real and that really do these things. And so, again, coming back to what we do in cellular medicine, if you understand these mechanisms and you understand these pathways, well, you just go at them. And that's why when we see things coming out, or we're looking for like this, waiting for something like this pentadienoic acid, a 15-chain fatty acid, which not only works there, but has what we call anaplorotic effects, where it can actually be pulled into the Krebs cycle and make energy. Nobody knows that. Or it can go the other way and help make things in the brain. It's amazing. I mean, to understand what a simple fatty acid that is healthy can do to offset, again, it's too much of something can be unhealthy. Too little of something can be unhealthy. How do we find the balance? And that's what we're trying to help people understand, that, you know, it gets back to this thing. Cholesterol is good for you.
Right.
Fats are good for you. All these things are good for you. It's just, hey, we're just trying to tease out this information and make it more informative and start more discussions and get more people asking questions. And then maybe we'll do a better job at answering them. And like I always learn that I need to understand and listen to people ask me these questions to explain it better and better and better. So
So, Doc, we don't have that much time left, but I think it's worth mentioning at least a little bit the Cliff's Notes version, Doc. You said this in maybe about 20 episodes back in this podcast that muscle plays an important role in prevention. Well, you didn't use prevention at the time. It was a more regenerative anti-aging plan. But you called it, it's the currency of the body, you know, what the body spends to do stuff, right? And it's how much of that plays into prevention? Because now that, you know, now that in Paris, we're in this state of recovery, it's the muscles are completely out. No movement is possible. How much of that could have been prevented had there been more muscle?
So muscle mass plays a big role because the body goes to muscle right away to actually pull out glutamine to start balancing things, basically. I mean, it's why muscle reserve is so important in controlling. It helps control metabolic issues like acidosis. It's unfortunately why women become osteopenic, why they become sarcopenic. It's because of muscle mass, actually. Not losing muscle mass is what starts. They hear about it later as being bone, but bone's down the road from muscle. And in referencing muscle, muscle has, as we're starting to find out, and as I've always said, it's a very, very large endocrine gland. It's the muscle is what absorbs most of your glucose. It's where diabetes starts in the muscle. It all starts in the muscle. So it should end in the muscle, right? It only makes sense if it starts in the muscle, should end in the muscle. And exercise, if we just look at exercise and actually not aerobic, but just resistance exercise, what if everybody understood that just resistance exercise, all of a sudden, it knocks out the ability of insulin resistance, meaning all of a sudden receptors that weren't working work with resistance exercise and bring glucose into muscle. That's fascinating, right? How is that possible? Wait, you're telling me something went bad, but all you did was some resistance exercise and you've improved glucose into the muscle? Over time, you mean you could improve insulin sensitivity? Absolutely. So those are some huge concepts that we need to understand, that muscle is incredible on just that level, okay? And aerobic activity does the same thing, but I'm just talking about muscle itself, and resistance exercise has a huge place. And then you get into this discussion about these things called exokines and myokines, which are peptides and proteins and other factors that are produced by muscle that we're just learning about. There's over like 700 of them, and we only know about 90 of them right now. I might have those numbers off a little bit, but it's that significant. And these are things like, do you know that muscle, just by exercising muscle, we make something called brain-derived neurotrophic factor that has a significant place in the brain to helping neurocognition? That's with just resistance exercise. That's a real deal. It's actually why you're starting to see this huge paradigm shift now in depression, in anxiety, where people actually do not aerobic, but do resistance exercise, and you can change the state of the brain. This is hot literature right now, that you can actually have a significant effect on depression and anxiety with resistance exercise. And it's because these are things, just like I said, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It'll kind of come together, as we've talked about that as being a very big influential part of anxiety and depression and so forth. There's a lot more to it, but I'm just giving you some examples of just some things that are produced right away with just that first day of resistance exercise. That's produced right away and goes right to the brain. Other factors go to the heart. Cancer prevention, oh my gosh, huge forefront right now on resistance exercise and how these become tumor suppressor type of myokines are released that can assist in like controlling and in decreasing metastasis and things that you think would be counterintuitive. because everybody says, oh, you're going to turn on mTOR. You're going to make things worse. No, actually, you make them better because you're doing things that the cell, again, remember how intelligent the body is. The body's always trying to do things to make itself better. Yeah, it has some bad players. It has some bad cells, but it's got a lot more better cells. And the better ones there, we're talking about muscle, that are trying to help the body compensate. And in that respect, people need to wake up and see what's happening there too. So I could go on and on and on about this. It's a topic gaining significant relevance at this point, and you can't deny it.
So glad that you mentioned those 15 pearls again here, just on muscle alone. I didn't know that diabetes starts in muscle. That's cool.
It starts first in muscle. Then we start to see it make its way to the, you know, basically to where the liver starts to be affected by it. And then the last place you see it where it becomes true diabetes is in fat. That's kind of the progression of how you should look at it. Maybe that makes sense. It's fat's the last place of where you turn off the effects of insulin on fat. And that's when all hell breaks loose, basically when you're inhibiting lipolysis of fat, meaning fat breakdown from fat. But it all starts with the muscle. All starts in the muscle.
So both types? Just type 2, right?
Well, type 1's different. I mean, type 1 is a hereditary thing. But even type 1 diabetics, you also... So that's a problem where you're just not making insulin, okay? Mm-hmm. So when you're not making insulin, then you're not able to, again, help glucose get into the cell. But exercise in type 1, same thing. Muscle will pull in glucose because receptors change from resistance exercise. It's another amazing tool that can be utilized in all types of insulin problems, even insulin resistance, or when you're not making enough insulin. So very important to understand that.
That's so cool. Oh my gosh, Doc. It totally derailed from my plans and questions that I had, but I think it derailed in the right direction. This was phenomenal. There's so many things that are, I think people can take away for doing things to help with their preventative plan. And gosh, if you like this episode, folks listening, you are going to love Dr. Seeds' keynote on preventative medicine at the Peptide World Congress happening August 18th through the 19th. It's just two short months away at the very, very beautiful Four Seasons Westlake Village. It's 15 minutes from Malibu, so we're calling it the Malibu Wellness Summit. This is a weekend dedicated to the art of wellness, right? All the things, you'll learn the cutting edge medical breakthroughs that are changing the face of healthcare, but you'll also experience elements outside of medicine that can help to enrich your life and your health, your mind, your body, your energy, all of those things. Very Southern California, because that's where I'm based out of. So we've got so many fun things planned for that entire weekend. We hope that you stay with us, but more importantly, we hope that you come and join us at the Peptide World Congress and hear all of these medical breakthroughs that Dr. Seeds goes into such fantastic detail. And you have some slides to follow on. So it's even more digestible, I would say. Folks, please do join us. Go visit peptideworldcongress.com for more details and sign up today, because it will sell out. For those of you who cannot join us in Malibu/Westlake Village, California, join us online, because you can watch everything happening. You can watch the main stage happening from the comfort of your own home on our live stream. My goodness, Doc, all about prevention. When crisis happens, how do you prevent it? We're at the, oh gosh, all of this was a huge, gigantic waking experience. But I have to thank you so much for helping me, for helping my family. And we are hopefully going to bring her back in like the next month. That's our goal, Doc. Thanks to you. Oh my goodness. Hopefully she will be at the Peptide World Congress. That's certainly the plan. And I think it's very doable. Thanks to you, Doc. So I love you so much. And thank you so much for these incredible, incredible tips for our listeners.
I think it's awesome that we have an opportunity to just help people become more educated, and yeah, that you're pushing this message forward, and you're going to you're just going to make a difference. I think for so many people, and understanding that there are actionable things that can be done that are very simple. You don't have to go into the detail that we go into to take it beyond, above and beyond, but it might get you interested in that. It might get you interested in understanding why this field's exploding and why we're here fixing problems and not treating symptoms. You know, movements like this only happen if things are working. And yeah, we've been doing this for a long time, but it takes a long time to gain traction. It takes a long time to adopt and adapt, and people to other physicians to start this, you know, down this road. And it's not an easy road. It's tough. It's a lot of information. It's a lot of learning that you're never given. But you know what? It's the most rewarding. It's the most rewarding and privileged and humbling parts of, I think, of my life I've ever been able to be part of. And just hearing from you, you know, that you've gone through this journey in your life. I mean, you're just a great example of where you started and where you're at, and how you still, the messaging for you still keeps changing as you start understanding more and more and more. And we're just trying to capture everybody we can and in any place we can to listen. And you're changing lives, Karen, and it's beautiful that you're able to share such a close thing, you know, to your heart with everyone and see the emotion and the significance of life, and that there's a place for all of us to make improvements, right?
There really is. There is. There's so much room for improvement always, and in such a constructive way. I know that I will now be joining you in surf and turf anytime I order a steak. So, folks, thank you for everything. Thank you for listening. We will be back again with another episode of the Cellular Medicine Podcast. Dr. Seeds, thank you again. See you next time.
Thank you, Karen.